In this third lecture of Unit 3, Component 11, we will continue our discussion of the historical perspectives around clinical decision support. The fourth and final approach to early diagnostic expert systems was called scoring and heuristics. In this approach, knowledge would be represented as profiles of findings that occur in diseases. Then there would be measures of importance and frequency for each finding in each disease. This approach was the most scalable of the early approaches to diagnostic decision support and resulted in some commercialized systems. Examples include Internist 1 QMR, DXplain, and Iliad. The original system to use this approach was Internist 1, and its goal was to develop an expert diagnostician in internal medicine. It was actually designed to mimic a particular expert diagnostician, Dr. Jack Myers, from the University of Pittsburgh, who was an old-style internist who would roam the halls of the hospital and make patient diagnoses based on his wealth of knowledge about different diseases. Internist 1 never quite matched Jack Myers. However, it evolved over time, particularly in the 1980s, as PCs became more prevalent. It then morphed into Quick Medical Reference, or QMR, where the goal was changed to enable users to explore the knowledge base and use that information in a clinical decision support fashion. DXplain was a system that used the principles developed in Internist 1 and QMR, but provided a wider disease coverage. It is actually still available for use. Iliad was another system that was developed commercially. It used the profiles of findings in diseases approach, but instead of the simple formulas that Internist 1 QMR used, it attempted to actually use Bayesian statistics in the diagnostic process. How did the Internist 1 QMR approach represent knowledge? It had disease profiles that consisted of findings known to reliably occur in the disease. These findings might be from the medical histories, such as the patient complaining of chest pain with certain characteristics, something detected on the exam, such as a heart murmur, or a laboratory result, such as a blood test showing a low hemoglobin, or an abnormality on a chest X-ray. Each finding in the knowledge base, regardless of the disease, also had a measure of import, or how important it was to explain. Some findings are important in disease, but are actually nonspecific, like fever. So fever has a lower import to explain than, say, chest pain, which occurs in many fewer diseases. Findings also have properties that help the database run more efficiently. Some of these are taboos, such that the system would not allow a male to have a pregnancy as a finding. Likewise, a female would not have findings that would lead to prostate cancer, such as a prostate nodule detected on a physical exam. For each of these findings in a disease, there would be two measures, evoking strength and frequency. Evoking strength is the likelihood of a disease given a finding, whereas frequency is the likelihood of a finding given a disease. How do you keep these two straight? In evoking strength, the finding might be completely nonspecific to that disease because it occurs in many diseases. Or it might be pathognomonic, which in essence means when the finding is present, the disease is present, and so was scored on a 0 to 5 scale. Frequency, on the other hand, is a measure of how often the finding occurs in a disease. The finding may have a high frequency, but be nonspecific and have a low evoking strength. Frequency is scored on a 1 to 5 scale. Here is a disease profile displaying the findings for acute myocardial infarction, shown in a screenshot from the QMR application. There are 134 findings, and they can be displayed in textbook order by history, symptoms, signs, and labs, or by frequency. Here, they're shown in textbook order, and we have expanded the symptoms of current illness. Some findings, such as chest pain substernal at rest and chest pain substernal lasting 20 minutes or more, have a pretty high frequency. But actually, the evoking strength is a little bit lower because these findings are not necessarily specific to myocardial infarction. How does the scoring actually work? What happens is the user enters the initial positive and negative findings. This creates a disease hypothesis for any disease that has one or more of its positive findings. Each disease hypothesis gets a score. There is a positive component that is based on the evoking strengths of all findings, showing what is evoking the disease. There is a negative component based on the frequency from findings that are expected to occur, but have been designated as not occurring. Each disease is then given a score, and a diagnosis is made when the top-ranking diagnosis is 80 points, which is what the algorithm uses, or is the equivalent to one pathognomonic finding above the next highest diagnosis. When a diagnosis is made and the user states it has been, all the findings of the disease are removed, and then subsequent diagnoses are made with the remaining findings. A 1982 paper from the New England Journal of Medicine describes this algorithm in detail. How did Internist 1 do relative to physicians? Like the other expert systems, it outperformed them. Some of you are familiar with the clinical cases in the New England Journal of Medicine, where a physician presents the case and then some expert gives the diagnosis. They looked at how Internist 1 performed, and it actually performed as well as the experts and better than the physician taking care of the patient, or a series of cases from the New England Journal of Medicine. Why was Internist 1 and then QMR not more widely used? It had a number of limitations. One of these was a steep learning curve, as it took much more time and effort to learn how to use both Internist 1 and QMR. Data entry in the 1970s and 1980s was also very time-consuming, as there was no point-and-click mouse, and everything had to be typed in. Another key issue with any type of diagnostic expert system is that diagnostic dilemmas are not really a major proportion of clinician information needs. It is much more common to be stumped by the results of a single diagnostic test. Another challenge of Internist 1 and QMR was that the knowledge base was incomplete. Internist 1 did evolve to QMR after it was found that there was less value in the case mode and more value in exploring the knowledge base. This allowed the user to rule in and rule out diseases based on findings that were present or absent, and to obtain differential diagnoses for a group of findings, and also to link to more detailed information on the diagnosis. A great deal of work took place in the 1960s, 1970s, and 1980s in diagnostic decision support. It was believed that was where medical informatics was going to have its biggest impact. In the late 1980s, however, it became apparent that the diagnostic process was too complex for computer programs and that the systems took too long in terms of time of use and really did not provide the information that clinicians truly needed. We have learned some other things recently. For example, diagnostic decision support systems are less effective than therapeutic systems. There was a general acknowledgement of the failure of expert systems and artificial intelligence to live up to the hype of the 1980s, not only in medicine but in other areas. However, we do need to keep in mind that diagnostic errors still occur and cause harm to patients. So even though the systems that were developed in the earlier era did not contribute useful solutions, we still have a problem to solve. Where are we headed now? Decision support evolved in the 1990s in tandem with the growing use of electronic health records. Rules and algorithms were actually found to be quite useful, and we will see later in this unit that they are used in modern systems, although not in the kind of diagnostic decision support way. Again, there was an evolution from broad-based diagnostic decision support to more narrow therapeutic decision support. A number of leaders in the field recently published a roadmap for decision support. The key pillars of decision support are having the best knowledge available to the physician when needed, making sure that there is high adoption and effective use, and continually improving the knowledge and the methods. There is continued effort in diagnostic decision support. For example, a system called Isabel. The company that markets it calls it a second-generation approach. One of its key features is that it uses natural language processing to take text that is entered and map that text into findings, so the user does not have to go through the long menu-driven entry process. Instead of trying to rank the diagnoses by probability, a list of the most likely differential diagnoses is given and grouped by body system. The system's not really attempting to make the diagnosis as much as it is strongly encouraging the user to think about what's at the top of its list. How does Isabel do? It was initially developed and validated for pediatrics, and in a clinical setting, it reminded users of one clinically important diagnosis 1 out of 8 times, or 1 in 8 cases. It was subsequently extended and evaluated in the emergency department, and was found to display the correct diagnosis in its list of 95% of the time. 90% of the time, it showed a diagnosis that a clinician expert thought was one that the system must not miss. The system has been expanded to adult internal medicine using the long-standing New England Journal of Medicine case reports. When the key text from a case was copied and pasted into Isabel, the correct diagnosis was displayed 48 out of 50 times from the 50 diagnoses. When the entire text of the article was pasted in, which included a lot more noise, 37 out of the 50 correct diagnoses showed up in these cases. One final approach that is somewhat tongue-in-cheek is Googling, or using the Google search engine to obtain information on the World Wide Web for a diagnosis. However, Google, with its billions of web pages, may actually hold latent knowledge that can be used to make a diagnosis. This came to light when a group of specialists were stumped on a case and someone went and typed the findings into Google, and sure enough, the correct diagnosis of a rare condition popped up, which turned out to be what the patient had. Someone then tested this approach in a study by entering 26 clinical cases from the New England Journal of Medicine into Google. The result was that 15 of the 26 had the correct diagnosis suggested in the top 3 suggested diagnoses.